This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. As Cubans pay their respects to Fidel Castro, many of Florida's Cubans are processing what his passing means and hoping it ushers in democracy. Meanwhile, the thawing of relations between Cuba and the United States under President Obama could freeze over again. President-elect Donald Trump took to Twitter this week, warning that the deal forged by this administration could go away. Here's his tweet. If Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people, and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate deal, said Trump. What opportunities have opened up for Florida companies with the restart of relations with Cuba? What does the U.S. and Florida have to lose if that détente is reversed? Was the thaw too fast, too soon? And has it really helped Cubans after decades of communist rule? We want to hear from you. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, Bertica Cabrera-Morris is a government and business consultant. She worked with presidential candidate Mitt Romney in 2012. She also worked with Marco Rubio during his first Senate campaign. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Stephen Vigil. Now, his parents fled Cuba in 1960. Stephen's a chess instructor. He grew up in the United States. He visited Cuba for the first time a couple of years ago. He joins us from his home in Merritt Island. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks a lot for having me, Matthew.
Bertica, let me start with you. What was your reaction when you heard the news about Fidel Castro's death?
Well, probably one of the biggest news in my life because, you know, as far as since I've been a grown woman, all I ever heard was when Fidel dies, we're all going back. So, you know, I don't think I would tell you that it one was of happiness. I don't believe I've had that in my heart, but it was a one of relief.
So when I wonder if you could kind of put in context what we're seeing in, you know, the streets of Miami, for example. There's been images of people celebrating, it looks like, protesting this week as well. What's going on there?
Well, you know, Hispanics are not monolithic. We Cubans are not either. We all have different ideals and different deals. I believe the people in Miami, the ones that you saw on the streets, have suffered a lot, like my parents did. You know, you see that generation that had to leave everything behind, probably celebrating the down of an era more than the down of a man.
How old were you when you left Cuba?
I was 13, almost 14.
So what kind of memories do you have of growing up there?
I have wonderful memories. I have, and you know, I had a very good life. So it was a great time to be alive in a beautiful island. My parents had great jobs. My mother was president of a company. She was way ahead of her time, an American company. And so, you know, and then I also remember Bay of Pigs. You know, I remember the bat of my dad being put in jail because he might help the United States of America. And for no reason at all, a person that was non-political was put in jail. And my mom was told every night that they were going to kill him.
Stephen Vigil, I wonder if I could turn to you now. What went through your mind when you heard that Castro was dead?
A sense of relief, almost disbelief. You know, finally the moment had arrived. Like Bertica was saying, a moment my parents thought was going to happen maybe 2 or 3 years after he came into power. So it was just a big moment just for myself and my family.
And when you see the images of folks celebrating here, that kind of outpouring of relief and you know, partying in some cases here in Florida, what goes through your mind?
Well, I can understand it. You know, there's a lot of pain there. You know, people's lives were uprooted. You know, my parents came when they were 18 and 19. They just had finished getting married. They had to flee. They lost everything. My grandfather's businesses were seized. You know, he is a consummate kind of Machiavellian despot, you know, and it just ruined a lot of lives, I think. And, you know, people are finally letting out some emotion. You know?
When you hear what's happening in Cuba, though, I mean, how do you kind of square that? Because if you listen to news reports of the, you know, the procession of the ashes through the streets and people kind of paying tribute to him, they have, it sounds like there's a very different perspective from folks on the island.
Well, you got to realize that these people's voice has been put down. You know, they have not been allowed to speak out against Castro. Mm-hmm. And I think there's kind of a love-hate relationship with people on the island. He's almost kind of like that evil father, you know, didn't allow you to do things you wanted to do and grow, but in some ways defended you, you know. He was a champion of the little guy. I think Cubans, to some degree, saw themselves as a David and the U.S. as a Goliath.
Mm-hmm. And things like education and healthcare, I mean, those are the things that, the Castro regime would point to and say, look at what we've done for the people of Cuba since the revolution.
Well, you would always hear, and I think that's what they're taught in their schools, el triunfo de la revolución, you know, the triumphs of the revolution. You know, the literacy rate is high, medicine is great. But you go to Cuba, and you can tell there's a sadness, there's a suffering to the people as well.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Talking about Cuba from here on out with Fidel Castro gone, what that means for Florida, for Cuba, for the United States, and the relationship between these two countries being so frozen for so long and thawing now. But what happens with Castro gone and with an incoming Trump administration? 1-866-338-5252. Beatica, let me bring you back in the conversation. Since the warming of relations between the United States and Cuba in 2014, we have seen travel from the United States increase. The first commercial flight from Orlando to Havana left this Tuesday, so kind of a big deal for Orlando. Is it a good thing for Cuba and for Florida's Cubans, the freeing up of travel?
Like we talked before, I think that there is a frozen generation or a lost generation that is under me, you know, probably in their early 50s to their 35.
Mm-hmm.
So for that generation, probably is a betterment of their life. But the thing here to fight for, and which I am very much in favor of continuing what has been started with a more negotiation, like President Trump said, is that I believe there is a new generation, the generation of my children, the millennials. That generation didn't ask for any of this. That generation is not revolutionary. Mm-hmm. That generation wants to do what my kids do. You know, they want to have computers and internet and telephones and travel and do all the wonderful things that we are accustomed to and in a democratic country you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that this change would be good for that group, and I like to help with that.
The way it stands now with increase in tourism, and there has been a pretty significant increase from the United States to Cuba in the last couple of years. Is it good for Cuba, do you think? Or can Cuba handle it with the infrastructure it has now?
No, they can. They need about 1 or 2 million more rooms. The thing is that in Cuba right now, the government owns all of the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we have one hotel or two that are owned maybe by private industry, but I think that the only way this will work is the model that we have in Eastern Europe, where we're allowed to bring in foreign capital. I mean, I think two things could help immediately: internet and banks.
Mm-hmm.
They have no banks whatsoever, so how could you get paid? And nobody's going to put their money in a place where you cannot get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, internet, so we can communicate with the world.
And when you say Eastern Europe, you're talking about after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
That's correct.
Right.
There are different models of communism fallen in China and Russia and some of the other areas in the USSR, obviously, mm-hmm. Russia. But it seemed like the Eastern Europeans got it right. And even if it's not perfect, they still have kind of a socialism, but they have a lot more freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a democracy in many ways.
And that's what you want to see in
I would prefer
Cuba.
That model than the model that they are following right now,
mm-hmm.
which is more like a China model and doesn't really work.
Going to go to the phones now. We've got El Marino. El Marino, you're on the air. I understand you just paid a visit to Cuba. What did you see there?
I went to Cuba as a beekeeper, and what I saw was poverty, but not misery. Mm-hmm. I happened to have the opportunity to visit inside the country independently, and I happened to go all the way to some towns in the next state to visit beekeepers out there and share ideas. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting to see, yes, the biggest problem they have is transportation, of moving their equipment. But what I saw was poverty, but not misery. Mm-hmm. And another thing that I noticed while in Havana was that a second economy has created, because I stayed at an Airbnb, and the people who stayed at an Airbnb are looking for a place to eat that is affordable mm-hmm. and cheap. And that created kind of off-the-grid places to eat that are not common with the tourists. So it was very interesting to eat for a dollar or two a day for mm-hmm. lunch, a very well lunch. And that created a second economy of people who were attaching onto the new tourist industry going down there.
El Marin, I'm wondering what the response from the Cubans was to you and to, you know, other interactions with tourists that you saw. I mean, what do they think of this influx of visitors?
They love it. They love it. They were very positive. I felt on a very safe place. I did travel off the grid. Like I said, I traveled in their buses. Mm-hmm. I traveled in their bicycles. I traveled in all the vehicles that they use. I even walked. And I felt very safe. They were very receptive. I met Germans. I met Italians. I met French. I met Spanish. And they were all in agreement that they felt is a beautiful island. People are very receptive, very welcome. And they were willing to show us more than we wanted to see. I actually got invited into a little house to look mm-hmm. For coffee. I thought it was pretty nice. So welcoming was very, very helpful.
Well, Al, thank you for your thoughts on that, and appreciate you calling in. I'm going to go to Mike now. Mike, what are your thoughts about the relationship between Cuba and the United States right now?
I just really think of the whole premise for the sanctions in the first place, that the fact that they're being slowly lifted now is absolutely the correct thing to do, that President-elect Trump should not be threatening to reimpose. It's just the whole premise of it was just naive, almost baby-like. Like, we are so mad that this country, 90 miles off our shore, became a communist country, that we're just going to sanction them and we're going to treat them completely differently than we do other communist nations just because they happen to be in our hemisphere. Mm-hmm. It just hurt the Cuban people. It continues to hurt the Cuban people. And any threats to reimpose are just, it sort of gets to a point where, you know, something happens and after time, people stop challenging the reason for it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is going on with these sanctions, is that they've been around for so long that no one is just sitting back and saying, look, why are we treating this country differently than we do other communist nations?
So, Mike, you want to see those sanctions lifted. Thanks for your call there. Bitika, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, we talked before about the kind of the pace of change, the detente there. Is it wise for an incoming president to be saying, look, we might rethink the lifting of sanctions if Cuba doesn't play ball?
Absolutely. I think President-elect Trump needs to get a deal. And right now, there are three issues that stand. Number one is they need to stop beating the people. You know, there is a 26-year-old right now called Sesto, which was put in jail because he did a little graffiti one night against in happiness or celebrating the change of an era because Fidel had died. That has to stop, human rights. Number two is we need to have a criminal that is in Havana that was there because she escaped the United States because she killed a policeman. Everybody needs to go through the justice system if they kill one of our policemen. I mean, can you imagine allowing that?
And in which case is this?
And it's in Chicago. I don't know her name, but she needs to be returned to the United States. The United States has asked for her return, and President-elect Trump has said she must be returned. Number three, there's some issues with churches that are being bulldozed down. If Cuba acts right now in any of these items, just one of them in good faith, I think it will go a long ways. I think this president is going to say, listen, this is like a bad divorce. Nobody's going to be happy at the end of the day, but this is about business. I'm going to go your way. You go my, you know, you go your way. I go mine. But let's see how we can make the best out of it. Mm-hmm. But you must, Cuba, do something. And it's, in good faith.
It's funny you kind of make the analogy of divorce, though, because what I think a lot of people want to see is the countries coming closer together.
Well, but in a divorce, we continue to live in the same city. Doesn't mean that we have to be in different worlds.
Sure.
You know, what I'm saying, divorce is, you know, the United States and Cuba went through a divorce a long time ago. When the United States, and I disagree a little bit with Mike, I was in Cuba when I saw the bombs go in front of my house. And I remember when Bay of Pigs. So the sanctions were put in place for a reason. Are the sanctions still a good idea? I don't think so. I agree. I think that we need to relook at that. And that's what I think President Trump is saying.
Stephen, let me just bring you back in this conversation. You visited Cuba a couple years back. What did you see there? What was your impression of the island, from the infrastructure to the people you met?
Well, the infrastructure is certainly dilapidated. It's antiquated. I felt to some degree, that it was almost like a time capsule. You could see how kind of progress had stopped somewhere in the 60s. And but as far as the people, people were just great. They were so gracious, so nice to me. My family took me in. Everybody I met was so full of life and music and had a nice spirit. I also felt safe there. You know, very little amount of crime. Transportation, it's just a nightmare. And aesthetically, Cuba's a beautiful place.
And it sort of comes back to that time capsule. I wonder, too, just quickly, Stephen, what are you hearing from friends and family there now with the passing of Fidel Castro?
Well, it's kind of interesting because my aunt that lives in Cuba was actually visiting our family from Cuba for the Thanksgiving holidays. And she didn't say much, you know. I just don't think that she wanted to get into it with my parents. I think... you know, Castro represents kind of a dream deferred, you know, what could have been. All the promises he made never came true. You know, the Cuba that he wanted never came true. And I think my aunt kind of feels that to a certain degree. But, you know, there's also some resentment towards the United States. Like Mike was saying, you know, the embargo is just an antiquated foreign policy, you know. It's a relic of the Cold War. It didn't work. You know, Castro was in power this long. So, you know, those are some of the feelings.
Bertica, in the last 30 seconds or so, I wonder what your thoughts are, if you had a couple of words of advice to give to President-elect Donald Trump as he thinks about Cuba-U.S. relations, what would you tell him?
Well, I think that he needs to look into what would make this negotiation better for that next generation in Cuba. He's going to hear from people that are far to your right, you know, the ones that you saw demonstrating. And then you're going to hear from the Democrats that, or the group that negotiated that deal with Cuba.
And of course, they don't want to see the deal go to waste.
Yeah, but, you know, they are becoming less relevant every minute. So what we need to do is we need to put together a group in the middle. And that group in the middle needs to give President Trump advice in how, what would we think. And I consider myself part of that group.
Well, Bertica Cabrera-Morris is a government and business consultant. Thank you so much for joining us, Bertica.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Stephen Vigil. He's a first-generation Cuban Floridian. He joined us from his home in Merritt Island. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thanks a lot.
Still to come, Orlando is the simulation capital of the country, and industry insiders see a Trump administration pumping even more money into the business of virtual war games and other military training. And writing music is one thing, but the lyrics are just as important. We chat with a local performer about songcraft. Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A lot of the training that US military personnel do before they are deployed is now virtual. And with President-elect Donald Trump pledging to rebuild the military, Orlando's simulation businesses see an opportunity for more contracts and more growth. I spent a few hours on the floor of ITSEC at the Orange County Convention Center. It's a trade show for the military simulation industry. And here you'll see people clad in fatigues from all parts of the world strapping on visors and zipping through the digital skies on the latest fighter plane simulator or testing their reflexes in virtual shooter simulations. Retired Lieutenant General Tom Batiste heads the National Center for Simulation in Orlando. So we're here on the convention floor. This is a big hall. There are a lot of companies here and a lot of them have a presence in Orlando. Give me a sense of how big this industry is for Orlando.
Well, the modeling and simulation industry is a $6 billion industry in the state of Florida. It directly employs 30,000 people across the state. The total jobs impact is nearly 80,000 people. The reason it's here is because there's a non-traditional Navy base called NSA Orlando that's the centerpiece or the anchor tenant of the Central Florida Research Park. And in that base, there are representation from the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marines, and eight other federal government agencies, and their contracting authority ranges between $3.8 to $4.8 billion annually in contracts that go to industry.
Now, with this incoming administration, are you hoping or thinking that that amount is going to bump up a bit?
Well, I think what I heard throughout the entire election process was Donald Trump saying that such things as very strongly that our military is broken. I think he realizes that there have been significant cuts in the, over the last 8 years, that we're struggling with readiness across all four of our services, that we've got a very uncertain world with problems in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, and many other areas of the world, and that everything that I've heard from him tells me that he is going to be very, very pro-defense. And if he can, you know, if he can get the support of both houses, which there's now a Republican majority in both houses, that we're going to see a bump up in the top line of the defense budget.
Do you think it's overstating it, though, to say that U.S. military is broken?
Oh, I think that's a bit overstated. We're still the most formidable force anywhere in the world, and we'll continue to be so. But I will tell you that we are struggling with aging equipment. We've slashed our research and development accounts in order to be able to live in a lower base budget. And so there are challenges out there. We've got old equipment. It's tough to maintain. We've got challenges in maintaining readiness because there's just fewer dollars to train with. So simulation becomes much more important when you think about that formula. How do you maintain the readiness of our four services with less money? Well, simulation becomes a much bigger part of that formula.
Are you hoping then, Tom Batiste, that there's going to be somebody in his ear giving him advice saying simulation needs to be at the front of the line when it comes to thinking about defense spending?
Well, I think what I see in his recruiting of cabinet members is a pretty heavy senior military presence. And they're smart individuals that have spent their lifetime in the military, and they know what it means to train. They know the way we train, and they know what we can do given limited resources. So I think there's going to be ample, very good advice that, you know, we've got to rely on simulation more today than we did yesterday, and that's just driven by constraints on how much money will be provided to defense in the current budget environment with deficit spending, national debt that's rising very, very quickly.
Do you have any idea of how much more you would like to see put into the simulation industry?
I don't think I could quantify how much it is. What it tells me is if there is an increase in the top line to the defense budget driven by our president-elect, that is going to trickle down, and we will see increases in the budget authority of all of our services here in the research park, which means that they can do more. They can maybe fund some programs and some requirements that just didn't make the cut because there was not enough money. So that translates to more opportunity for industry and good, you know, good things for Orlando.
So if there are two or three programs that you would be able to tell President-elect Donald Trump to put his efforts into funding, what would they be?
Well, that's a tough one.
Which areas do you want to see some focus on?
Well, I think an emerging area is virtual reality and augmented reality. And the reason for that is, you know, we've been at war for nearly 15 years in Afghanistan and Iraq. The troops have been deployed into theater for years and years, and the rotations have been continuous. Well, with drawdowns in Afghanistan and Iraq, we have more of our troops at home. How do you train at home? How can you get the maximum benefit for every training hour? And augmented reality and virtual reality, I think, offers some solutions that all of the services are pursuing, because you can train at home station in a room as small as a classroom, you know, in a virtual world. And you don't need 10,000 acres of range space and live weapons and targeting and all that sort of thing. You can do things to keep the force practicing their tactics, techniques, and procedures in a virtual world using virtual reality and augmented reality. So I think that's an area that shows great promise, and all the services are looking toward how can they leverage that.
When you look at the military, you know, a new recruit going into the field, how much training have they done virtually versus real live training compared to, say, when you were just getting started?
Well, this is the way I'd answer your question. When I first started flying airplanes in the early 70s, simulation wasn't very good. I wasn't very, very enamored with going to the F4 simulator. It was more of a part-task trainer than a full-fledged simulator. Well, that's changed. I mean, my last flight in the F-16 was 22 years ago. So what industry can deliver today is incredibly good. And we're approaching the point where we can suspend disbelief with our simulators. So they're no longer just a carnival ride, a fun thing to do. They're a serious training tool that can be a much bigger part of the readiness challenge. So you can never replace all live training. You must fly the airplane, you must drive the tank, you must drive the truck, steer the ship, all those things you have to do in the real weapon system at some point in time. But the more you can do in the simulator, the less it costs you to train, and industry is delivering capability that's much more acceptable, if you will.
I mean, they're still producing F-16s today, so would you be able to jump into the cockpit and fly one of those? Would you need a bit of a tune-up?
If I could get it started, I think I could fly it. I might not remember exactly how to get it started and going through all the pre-takeoff checks and all that sort of thing, but I don't think the flying would be that would come back. You know, it's like riding a bike.
Tom Batiste, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
A few booths over is JHT. It's a company founded by former B-52 pilot Jim Jardine. They're working on some sophisticated touchscreen technology. So tell me a little bit about your company, Jim Jardine. You're based here in Orlando?
We are. We've been here for 26 years now, and we've been all sizes. We've been small, we've been big, and we've been, you know, medium. But we do a lot about mostly now web-based training, and we outsource people to the government, different locations.
So tell me in a little more detail what you all are doing here, and some of the things that you're looking to sell or looking for some interest in.
Well, we have various and sundry products. We've actually gotten kind of into the product development. We have a software program called Proximity, a unique way of using touchscreen technology and moving parts and using the right pressures and that kind of thing that is an advance in the system of modeling and simulation.
How would it be used? Would it be used for somebody maybe doing like training in an aircraft simulator?
Like in a submarine trainer loading torpedoes into the tube. There's actions that require turning of valves and moving things off tables and things that are manual labor that you don't really have to do because it's all on the screen and it's simulated. And it's very effective because you can, in the old days, you just kind of did a finger touch and something moved. Now if you want it to move, you touch and it can be more than one finger, like turning a valve. And if it takes 10 pounds of pressure, it takes 10 pounds of pressure for you to turn. If it takes 25 pounds of pressure, it's harder to turn. And I use that as an example, but there's all kinds of opening the doors, the torpedo tubes. The hardware and software is advancing so much now that you can do a lot of interesting things. You could even use this for surgery, teaching surgeons, teach them how to use scalpels and stuff and not kill somebody. You know, I haven't convinced the doctors that that's the best way to go yet, but we'll get there.
So what I'm hearing is that it's not just military applications. You're also looking at civilian use for this technology?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's I don't know what I don't know yet, you know, in terms of where we can use it. This is a great place to exhibit what you can do because it's not while it's predominantly military, both national and international, there's a lot of private companies and a lot of medical people are here, because the medical community has embraced modeling and simulation and training quite a bit in the last few years. I think it has lots of applications. I just don't know what they all are yet.
So how many people are in your company at the moment?
170, and growing again. We've been up and we've been down. We're in a growth mode now, so we're pretty happy about that.
How big do you want to get?
The sky's the limit, but probably 250, 300 is a good manageable size.
Have you had a go on some of the simulators here?
Not lately. They are so much more advanced than what I trained in. You know, now you have full motion simulators and they can be flying in the simulator and collaborating with actual airplanes in the air around the world, and it's almost incredible, but it's credible. You know, it's the way training is done now.
Do you ever see training, the kind of immersive simulation you have now, totally replacing the real thing?
No. Sooner or later, you got to strap the airplane on and you got to go fly it. But I will also say that I know for a fact that the people who have trained in the simulators, along with their, you know, like in pilot training and subsequent mission aircraft training, they are better trained for the work they do in the simulators when they get in the air.
Well, Jim Jarden, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for coming by.
Up next, a musician who goes by the name Nature joins us for a performance and talks about the tricky art of lyric writing. Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando musician Nate Figueroa performs under the alias Nature. Intersection's Brendan Byrne spoke to him about the art of songwriting and lyrics. He began by performing a song called Strike a Line.
Wasting time, and it's on your mind, and you don't know why. Oh, I feel you before, and you don't want no more. No more is just lies. Just try, it could all be so simple. Fade away into the light of day. Just vibes I don't provide. All alone, I have cornered you with concern. When I slip into progress, don't want what you're offering. Let it go, don't wanna let it go, don't wanna let it just get. I know where your head is. Years ago, I'm talking years ago. When we stumbled upon it, the gauntlet it has been thrown. Cause all alone I have cornered you with concern again. And do you speak softly towards me? Or are you free to choose escaping from these four walls? Promise me when we make believe to see more than you'd ever imagine. Take that swinging bullshit as a habit, do you? Never pass judgment and never hold up. Never hold grudges, Lord, it poisons my soul. Always give up when it's thankless is trusted. Remember to keep your tides high. It's only phases of the moon in that tune. It's mazes, amazement, and cool to be true. Do you see what's happened to me? I've been alarmed and harmed and hurt from the inside. Promise me you'll do your best to see more than you anticipated, more than my love is frustrated. Do you? See the mirror, I see Jesus, I see Vera, do you? I don't need promotion, I need oceans and appearance, do you? I
see no comparison. My heart's a heavy bearer. Do you? I don't see hysteria. Aquarius are scary. Do you? Do you see what's happened to me? I've been alarmed and harmed and hurt from the inside. Promise me when we make believe to see more than you'd ever imagine. Take that swinging bullshit as a habit. Do you?
What got you started in music?
My grandfather was a musician, and when I was young, he taught me how to play the piano. And a few years later, I picked up the guitar, and he was, you know, surprised by it because he used to play in a band in the 60s, and he used to, you know, kill it on stage. So when he found out I was interested in music, he went and bought me my first guitar and got me a couple CDs. And I watched the first tape, and I was like, all right, this is cool, but I'm learning at another man's pace right now, and it's not really my speed. So I kind of just took it and ran with it, and he showed me how to play the House of the Rising Sun, and then from there I just learned how to play guitar.
So you taught yourself how to play?
Yeah.
What about having that piano background? Did that kind of help you understand music and theory and all that?
Oh yeah. Piano is, I don't know, piano and guitar is one of the best things. A little history lesson. A guy played the guitar once, and he brought it to the orchestra. And they told him, you can't play the guitar in an orchestra because it's not a string instrument. They didn't call it a string instrument. They said, bring it back if you can play the guitar like a piano can be played. And sure enough, the dude was like, all right, here, he came back, and now the guitar is an orchestral instrument. So I thought that was pretty cool. So that kept me interested in both of them. It kept them connected for me.
Mm-hmm. And just hearing that song, there was quite a few different techniques you played on guitar to kind of make it sound a little bit different. You had some percussive stringing there, some bar chords, all that stuff. It really all came together. It sounded like an orchestra when you were playing it.
Thanks.
What are some of your influences, Nate? What you said your first song was House of the Rising Sun, and that kind of lead you on the way to your music?
You know, House of the Rising Sun, Hotel California, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Bob Marley, Lauryn Hill, Ziggy Marley. From a lyrical standpoint, it's Eminem, B.B. King as a guitarist and a performer, Michael Jackson as a performer, of course, you know, all the pretty standard legends, you know, I'd say.
B.B. King to Eminem, that's a pretty broad spectrum of influence you have there.
Yeah, thanks, I guess.
Well, what are you going to play next for us?
It's a song called Brevity. Actually, it's called Good Intentions. The name was changed a couple months ago. I can get into it.
Take it away.
What could you possibly know about the brevity of life? We figure, we wonder, we plummet, we plunder long as we're acting right. Oh, long as we're acting right. Maintain a posture, sit up straight. We got a couple pretty ladies keeping food on our plates, but don't take that for granted, cause it's never too late for her to back it up and move a pretty ass up the gate. And to the women who obsessing over feminine ways, remember no obsession is the healthier way. And trying to change a man's mind is only speaking to the half of them, cause everybody got that other side that be distracting them. Men can get uncomfortable if women stop harassing them. Think women get uncomfortable because we don't go after them, when really you just gotta learn to love the side you learn to keep. And to take yourself, imagine life and possibility. Anybody real can open up so they can really see. Imagine how much stronger we could be if it was you and me. Whoa, whoa. And I don't know much more than the next man, and I don't feel any more than you, and I don't wish too much to succeed. But I need, oh, I need to be of value. So let me get it all straight. The people in my city see me as a little too late. Well, maybe that's because I stopped serving them food on a plate. Or maybe following the tide is instant gratification. See more appealing than a ride on a wave. But it's cold, I ain't got nothing but a smile and a wave. But if I could, I would have kept it on my P's and Q's. Dot the tip across my eyes never occurred to you. Like,
Still young, wanna work on my craft so that way when I take it up, it stays up and we can relax. And I made a couple promises and wrote it's where the bondage is. Beyond it is the rest of the way paid. And honestly, my head still hurts. There's still a million things I gotta get through first. But I gotta love my brothers, gotta work inside the struggle, hustle up and buckle down and rise above. And now when I don't know much more than the next man, and I don't feel any more than you. And I don't wish too much to succeed. But I need, oh, I need to be all about you. We plunder long as we're acting right. Oh, long as we're acting right.
You're listening to Intersection here on 90.7 News. I'm Brendan Byrne. In the studio with us is Nature. He's a singer-songwriter based out of Central Florida here. That was I could see the influence of some of those hip hop artists before, those lyricists there with that particular verse there. How do you write the kind of the wordplay and the rap like that?
It just flows out. There's no explanation. There's no way to break it down in scientific terms or any way to just like split it up for like an A B section or anything like that. Like, no, it's just the words come out on the page. I mean, I like to rhyme words together, and sometimes they make sense.
Are you able to write them down fast enough as they're coming out?
Barely. You got chicken scratch on a page.
that brings me to one of the things I did want to talk to you about is lyrics, and that's the one thing that really stands out listening to you is it's really you put a priority on writing these lyrics. How do you go about finding the inspiration to write the words to your songs?
It's all circumstantial. And I'll hear something on the news, I'll overhear a conversation or an argument, and then just be inspired to say, all right, you know, listen, I'm going to take this moment, I'm going to capitalize on it, and when I play it for people, I'm going to hope and pray on stage that, you know, these people are moved by it. And, you know, subconsciously, when people hear things that they enjoy, they go about their day and their mood's a little bit more lifted, you know. And hopefully a good deed, you know, will continue to transport itself, you know, across the world.
I want to ask you a chicken and the egg question here. What comes first with you? Do you write your lyrics first and then music, or do you write the melody and the tune and then the lyrics?
I write the music first.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of do them both. I flip-flop back and forth. You know, I'll play something that I hear. I'll just be, like, doodling on guitar and figure out what I'm going to do. And then I'll hear something I like, be like, oh, that's cool, and expand on that and build an idea and then write the idea and then, you know, build another one. And sometimes it happens all at once. Sometimes it's over a span of days, weeks, or months.
Do you have to set time aside and say, hey, this is going to be a songwriting day, or does it just kind of happen and show up?
Kind of just happens, and sometimes it inconveniences other people.
We've had quite a few musicians on the program, and they say they'll sing into their smartphone or whatnot. Is that something that you'll do if you're out there inconveniencing people when a song comes to you?
No, I can't do that, man. I've tried before. I really have tried. I'm like, okay, this is a good idea, and I'm going to come back to it. But I'm so inconsistent that I'll sing something, I'll listen to it, be like, hey, that was a good idea. Was a good idea. Is no longer. So I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever, next song.
While we're talking about lyrics, there was the news of Leonard Cohen's passing. But in better news, there was Bob Dylan receiving the Nobel Prize for lyrics. Do you think that the spotlight now is back on lyrics and great lyricists in music? Do you think that these two events are really helping people understand the importance of words?
I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, whoever's listening to these kinds of things is definitely a music appreciator, somebody who's taken to the art of lyric writing. But as for the people that aren't really listening to the music like that, we just got to keep making it. You know, there's got to be some kind of rift that we can create that just absorbs the attention of people, at least as lyricists, you know, people who consider themselves lyricists. I consider myself a lyricist, so I'm hoping that, you know, it attracts the people that aren't really listening just yet.
When you think to some of those lyricists and musicians that influenced you and you listen to their music, is there one particular line or song that you say, man, I really wish I came up with that?
Yeah. That goes for a lot of songs. There's everything that ever inspired me, I wish I wrote. You know, so that goes from, like, there is a house in New Orleans they call the Rising Sun, and it's been the ruin of many a poor boy, and God, I know I'm one. What? Yeah, I would love to have written that line. No, but I don't know nothing about New Orleans just yet. So.
Well, Nate, how about you play us another song, could you?
Cool. Yeah, this one is called 2016, and it has to do a lot with manifestation. I'm pretty big into, you know, believing in, of course, the universe and, you know, how people interpret their everyday lives and how you can speak things into existence or basically just live how you want your life to be. 2016. Here we go.
Free yourself from your mind. Are you making sure you're wasting time? Do you see all the things that come in between? Are you making sure you're living your dream? Are you making sure you're living your dream?
You're listening to Nate Figueroa on Intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Thanks for helping us make our first silent drive a success. Intersection's producer is Brandon Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Our intern is Talia Blake. You can find this and previous episodes on our website, WMFE.org, or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
Maintaining the roots. Can't blame it on you. I can't do that anymore. This life is dangerous. I probably got shut down. I'm amazed at it. Look what you done found. Cause I'm bounded by the fountain. I did not deliver you from your man.